It had once been orange, but was now faded to a dull peach, and next to its red handle was an ominous warning against smoking during deployment.
After the grenade goes off, and our beloved vessel slips below the waves, I have been ordered to deploy this, lest we lose the life of our resident hero. I don't have to tell you the trust that has been placed in us to receive such a gift.
The second mate stepped forward, almost as if he was afraid of the thing, to inspect the Cyrillic writing.
It's bigger than the other one, he said.
A whole plane load of people could fit in that raft, the machinist told him. Or the greatness of one hero.
Yeah, the first mate said. I, for one, would be honored to tread water next to a raft that contained a true hero of the Eternal Revolution. But the captain wasn't done.
And I figure it is time to make the third mate an official member of our crew.
He withdrew from his pocket a folded piece of waxed paper. Within this were 9 fine sewing needles, cauterized together. The tips of the needles were blackened from many tattooings.
I'm no Russian, he told Jundo. But you'll see I became pretty handy at this. And here we don't even have to worry about the ink freezing.
In the galley, they reclined Jundo upon the table and had him take off his shirt. When the pilot saw Jundo's naked chest, he said,
Ah, a virgin!
And everyone laughed. Look, Jundo said, I'm not so sure about this. I'm not even married.
Relax, the captain said. I'm going to give you the most beautiful wife in the world.
While the pilot and the first mate flipped through the calendar of the actress Sun Moon, the captain sprinkled his powdered ink into a spoon and mixed it with drops of water until it was just wetter than paste. The calendar had hung for a long time in the pilot house, but Jundo had never really given it much attention because it reeked of the patriotism that came over the loudspeakers. He'd only ever glimpsed a couple of movies in his life, and those were Chinese war movies his unit was shown during bad weather days in the military. Certainly there had been posters around for Sun Moon's movies, but they must not have seemed to apply to him. Now, watching the first mate and pilot flip through the movie posters, discussing which one had the best image and expression for a tattoo, he was jealous of the way they recalled famous scenes and lines of North Korea's national actress. He noted a depth and sadness in Sun Moon's eyes, the faint lines around them bespeaking a resoluteness in the face of loss, and it took everything in him to suppress the memory of Rumina. And then the idea of a portrait of any person placed over your heart forever seemed irresistible. How was it that we didn't walk around with every person who mattered tattooed on us forever? And then Jundo remembered that he had no one that mattered to him, which was why his tattoo would be of an actress he'd never seen, taken from a calendar at the helm of a fishing boat.
If she's such a famous actress, Jundo said, then everyone in North Korea will recognize her and know she's not my wife.
The tattoo, the captain said, is for the Americans and South Koreans. To them, it will simply be a female face.
Honestly, Jundo said, I don't even know why you guys do this. What's the point of tattooing your wife's face on your chest? The second mate said,
Because you're a fisherman, that's why. So they can identify your body, the pilot said.
The quiet machinist said,
So that whenever you think of her, there she is.
Oh, that sounds noble, the first mate said. But it's to give the wives peace of mind. They think no other woman will sleep with a man who has such a tattoo. But there are ways, of course. There are girls.
There is only one reason, the captain said. It's because it places her in your heart forever.
Jundo thought about that. A childish question came to him, one that marked him as someone who had never known any kind of love. Are you placing Sun Moon in my heart forever? He asked.
Oh, our young third mate, the captain said, smiling to the others. She's an actress. When you see her movies, that's not really her. Those are just characters she plays.
Jundo said, I haven't seen her movies.
There you go, then, the captain said. There's nothing to worry about.
What kind of name is Sun Moon? Jundo asked.
I guess she's a celebrity, the captain said. Maybe all the Yangbans in Pyongyang have strange names.
They selected an image from Tyrants Asunder. It was a headshot, and instead of staring duty-bound toward a distant imperialist army, or looking up to Mount Baekdu for guidance, Sun Moon here regarded the viewer with a reverence for all they would have lost together by the time the final movie credits rolled. The pilot held the calendar steady, and the captain began with her eyes. He had a good technique. He'd draw the needles backward, teasing them in and out of the skin with the kind of shimmy you use to cinch a bosun's knot. That way the pain was less, and the needle tips went in at an angle, anchoring the ink. The captain used a wet rag to wash away stray ink and blood. As he worked, the captain wondered aloud to himself.
What should the third mate know of his new wife? He mused. Her beauty is obvious. She is from Pyongyang, a place none of us will ever see. She was discovered by the dear leader himself and cast in A True Daughter of the Country, the first North Korean movie. How old was she then?
16, the first mate said. That sounds about right, the pilot said. How old are you? He asked the second mate.
20?
20, the pilot said. That movie was made the year you were born.
The roll of the ship seemed not to bother the captain at all.
She was the darling of the dear leader, and she was the only actress. No one else could star in a movie, and this went on for years. Also, despite her beauty, or because of it, the dear leader would not allow her to marry, so that all of her roles were only roles, as she did not know herself, of love.
But then came Commander Ga, said the machinist.
Then came Commander Ga,
the captain repeated in the absent way of someone lost in fine details.
Yes, he is the reason you don't have to worry about Sun Moon being placed too deeply in your heart.
Jundo had heard of Commander Ga. He was practically preached in the military as a man who'd led 6 assassination missions into South Korea, won the Golden Belt in Taekwondo, and purged the army of all the homosexuals. The second mate said,
Commander Ga even fought a bear.
I'm not so sure about that part,
the captain said, outlining the subtle contours of Sun Moon's neck.
When Commander Ga went to Japan and beat Kimura, everyone knew that upon his return to Pyongyang, he would name his prize. The dear leader made him Minister of Prison Mines, which is a coveted position, as there is no work to be done. But Commander Ga demanded possession of the actress Sun Moon. Time passed. There was trouble in the capital. Finally, the dear leader bitterly relented. The couple married, had 2 children, and now Sun Moon is remote and melancholy and alone.
Everyone went quiet when the captain said this, and Jundo suddenly felt for her. The second mate threw him a pained look.
Is that true?
He asked.
Do you know that's how she ended up?
That's how all wives end up, the captain said.
Late that night, Jundo's chest hurt, and he yearned to hear from the girl who rowed in the dark. The captain had told him that seawater would keep the tattoo from getting septic, but Jundo wouldn't take the chance of going up top for a bucket and missing her. More and more he felt as if he was the only one in the world who understood her. It was Jundo's curse to be nocturnal in a nation without power at night. But it was his duty, too. Like picking up a pair of oars at sunset, or letting the loudspeakers fill your head as you sleep. Even the crew thought of her as rowing toward dawn, as if dawn was a metaphor for something transcendent or utopian. Jundo understood that she was rowing until dawn, when with weariness and fulfillment she could pack it in for sleep. It was deep into the night when he finally found her signal faint from traveling so far from the north.
The guidance system is broken, she said. It keeps saying the wrong things. We're not where it says we are. We can't be. Something's out on the water, but we can't see it.
The line went quiet, and Jundo reached to fine-tune the signal. Then she was back.
Does this work?
She asked.
Is it working? There's a ship out there. A ship without lights. We shot it with a flare. The red streak bounced off the hull. Is anyone out there? Can anyone rescue us?
Who was attacking her? He wondered. What pirate would attack a woman who wished nothing more than to make her way through the dark? Jundo heard a pop over the line. Was it the pop of gunfire? And parading through his head came all the reasons it was impossible to rescue her. That she was too far north. That the Americans would find her. That they didn't even have maps of those waters. All true, but of course the real reason was him. Jundo was why they couldn't chart a course to rescue her. He reached forward and turned off the receiver, the green afterimage of its dials lingering in his eyes. He felt the sudden static of cool air when he removed his headphones. Up on deck, he scanned the horizon, looking for the lone red arc of her emergency flare. "Lose something?" the captain asked. He was just a voice from the helm. Jundo turned to see the tip of his glowing cigarette. "Yeah," Jundo said. "I think I did." The captain didn't leave the pilot house.
"That boy's pretty messed up right now," he said. "The last thing he needs is some craziness from you."
Using a lanyard, Jundo fished a bucket of water from the sea and poured it on his chest. He felt the pain as a memory, something from long ago. He looked upon the sea some more. The black waves would rise and clap, and in the troughs between them, you could imagine anything was out there.
"Someone will save you," he thought. "If you just hold tight long enough, someone's bound to."
The crew put down long lines all day, and when Jundo woke at sunset, they were bringing aboard the first sharks. Now that they'd been boarded by Americans, the captain was no longer afraid of being boarded by Americans. He asked that Jundo channel the broadcast through a speaker on the deck. It would be late, Jundo warned them, before the naked rower checked in, if that's what they were hoping for. The night was clear, with regular rollers from the northeast, and the deck lights penetrated far into the water, showing the red eyeshine of creatures just a little too deep to make out. Jundo used the array antenna and rolled the crew through the whole spectrum, from the ultra-low booms of sub-to-sub communications to the barking of transponders guiding jet autopilots through the night. He let them listen to the interference caused when the radar of distant vessels swept through them. At the top of the dial was the shrill rattle of a Braille book broadcaster, and out there at the very peak was the trance-like hiss of solar radiation in the Van Allen belts. The captain was more interested in the drunk Russians singing while they operated an offshore drilling platform. He muttered every fourth or fifth line, and if they gave him a minute, he said, he'd name the song. The first three sharks they brought aboard had been eaten by a larger shark, and nothing remained below the gills. Jundo found a woman in Jakarta who read English sonnets into a shortwave, and he approximated them as the captain and mates examined the bite radius and peered through the shark's empty heads. He played for them two men in unknown countries who were attempting to solve a mathematical problem over a ham radio, but it proved very difficult to translate. For a while, Jundo would stare toward the northerly horizon. Then he would force himself not to stare. They listened to planes and ships and the strange echoes that came from the curve of the earth. Jundo tried to explain concepts like FedEx, and the men debated whether a parcel could really be sent between any two humans on Earth in 24 hours. The second mate kept asking about the naked rower.
"I bet her nipples are like icicles," he said. "And her thighs must be white with goose pimples."
"We won't hear from her until dawn," Jundo said. "No use talking about it till then."
The machinist said,
"You need to look out for those big American legs.
Rowers have strong backs, the first mate said.
I bet she could tear a mackerel in half. Tear me in half, please,
the second mate said.
Wait till she finds out I'm a hero. I could be an ambassador. We could make some peace.
The captain said,
And wait till she finds out you like women's shoes.
I bet she wears men's shoes,
the pilot said.
Cold on the outside, and warm on the inside,
the second mate said.
That's the only way.
Jundo turned to him. You want to shut up about it already? The novelty of radio surveillance suddenly wore off. The radio played on, but the crewmen worked in silence, nothing but the winches, the flapping of ventral fins, and the sound of knives. The first mate was rolling a shark to cut its anal fin when a flap opened, and from it was ejected, viscous and yolk-covered, a satchel of shark pups, most of them still breathing from sacks. These the captain kicked in the water, and then called for a break. Rather than sink, they lay flat on the surface, floating with the ship, their half-formed eyes bulging this way and that. The men smoked Consol cigarettes, and up on the hatches felt the wind on their faces. They never stared toward North Korea in moments like these. Always it was east, toward Japan, or even farther out into the limitless Pacific. Despite the tension, a feeling came over Jundo that he sometimes got as a boy after working in the orphanage's fields, or whatever factory they'd been taken to that day. The feeling came when, with his group of boys, he'd been working hard, and though there was still heavy lifting to be done, the end was near, and soon there would be a group dinner of millet and cabbage and maybe melon skin soup. Then sleep. Communal, 100 boys bunked 4 tiers deep. All their common exhaustion articulated as a singularity. It was nothing short of belonging, a feeling that wasn't particularly profound or intense. It was just the best he tended to get. He'd spent most of his life since trying to be alone, but there were moments aboard the Junma where he felt a part, and that came with a satisfaction that wasn't located inside, but among. The scanners were rolling through the frequencies, playing short selections of each, and it was the second mate who first cocked his head at the tenor of something he'd heard before.
It's them,
he said.
It's the ghost Americans.
He slipped off his boots and began to climb barefoot up the pilot house.
They're down there again, he said. But this time, we've got them.
The captain shut down the winch motor so they could hear better.
What are they saying? He asked.
Jundo ran to the receiver and isolated the broadcast, fine-tuning it, even though the reception was strong.
Queen to night 4, Jundo said. It's the Americans. There's one with a Russian accent. Another one sounds Japanese.
All of the Americans were laughing, clear as a bell over the speaker. Jundo translated.
Look out, Commander, he said. Dimitri always goes for the rook.
The captain went to the rail and stared into the water. He squinted and shook his head.
But that's the trench, he said. Nothing can go that deep.
The first mate joined him.
You heard them. They're playing chess down there.
Jundo craned his neck to the second mate, who had shinnied up the pole and was working on unhooking the directional.
Careful of the cable, he called,
then checked his watch, almost 2 minutes in. Then he thought he heard some Korean interference over the broadcast, some voice talking about experiments or something. Jundo raced to narrow the reception and squelch out the other transmission, but he couldn't get rid of it. If it wasn't interference, he tried to keep his mind from thinking that a Korean was down there too.
What are the Americans saying?
The captain asked. Jundo stopped to translate.
The stupid pawns keep floating away.
The captain looked back into the water.
What are they doing down there?
Then the second mate got the directional off the pole, and the crew went silent as he aimed it into the deeps. Quietly, they waited as he slowly swept the antenna across the water, hoping to pinpoint the source of the transmission, but they heard nothing. "Something's wrong," Jundo told him. "It must have come unplugged." Then Jundo saw a hand pointing into the sky. It was the captain's, and it was aimed at a point of light racing through the stars.
"Up there, son,"
the captain said. And as the second mate lifted the directional and lined it up with the arc of light, there was a squeal of feedback, and suddenly it sounded like the American, the Russian, and the Japanese voices were right there on the ship with them. Jundo said,
"The Russian just said, 'That's checkmate.' And the American is saying, 'Bullshit. The pieces floated away. That's grounds for a new game.' And now the Russian is telling the American, 'Come on, give up the board. We might have time for a rematch of Moscow versus Seoul before the next orbit.'"
They watched the second mate track the point of light to the horizon, and when the light went around the curve of the Earth, the broadcast vanished. The crew kept staring at the second mate, and the second mate kept staring at the sky. Finally, he looked down at them.
"They're in space together," he said. "They're supposed to be our enemies, but they're up there laughing and screwing around."
He lowered the directional and looked at Jundo.
"You were wrong," he said. "You were wrong. They are doing it for peace and fucking brotherhood."
Jundo woke in the dark. He rose on his arms to sit on his bunk, silent, listening. For what? The frost of his breath was something he could feel occupying the space before him. There was just enough light to see water sheen on the floor as it shifted with the movement of the ship. Fish oil that seeped through the bulkhead seams, normally a black gloss down the rivets, was stiff and milk-colored with the cold. Of the shadows in his small room, Jundo had the impression that one of them was a person, perfectly still, hardly breathing. For a while, he held his breath too. Near dawn, Jundo woke again. He heard a faint hissing sound. He turned in his sleep toward the hull, so that he could imagine through the steel the open water at its darkest just before sunrise. He put his forehead to the metal, listening, and through his skin, he felt the thump of something nudging the side of the ship. Up top, the wind clipped cold across the deck. It made Jundo squint. The pilot house was empty. Then, Jundo saw a mass off the stern, something sprawling in gray-yellow in the waves. He stared at it a moment before it made sense, before he understood it was the life raft from the Russian jetliner. Where it was tethered to the ship, several tins of food were stacked. Jundo kneeled and held the rope in disbelief. The second mate popped his head from the raft to grab the last tins.
"Back!"
he said at the sight of Jundo. He took a deep breath, composed himself.
"Hand me those tins," he said.
Jundo passed them down.
"I saw a man defect once," he told the second mate. "And I saw what happened to him after he was brought back." "You want in? You're in," the second mate said. "No one will find us. The current is southerly here. No one's going to bring us back."
"What about your wife?"
"She's made up her mind, and nothing's going to change it," he said. "Now hand me the rope."
"What about the captain? The rest of us?"
The second mate reached up and untied the rope himself. He pushed off. Floating free, he said,
"We're the ones at the bottom of the ocean. You helped me see that."
In the morning, the light was flat and bright, and when the crew went on deck to do their laundry, they found the second mate gone. They stood next to the empty locker, trying to scan the horizon, but the light off the wave caps was like looking into a thousand mirrors. The captain had the machinist inventory the cabin, but in the end, little was missing but the raft. As to the second mate's course, the pilot shrugged and pointed east, toward the sun. So they stood there, looking and not looking, at what had come to pass.
His poor wife, the machinist said. They'll send her to a camp for sure,
the first mate said.
They could send us all away, the machinist said. Our wives, our kids.
Look, Jundo said. We'll say he fell overboard. A rogue wave came and washed him away.
The captain had been silent until now.
On our first trip with a life raft.
We'll say the wave washed the raft overboard.
Jundo pointed at the nets and buoys.
We'll throw that stuff over too.
The captain pulled off his hat and his shirt, and these he tossed aside, and he didn't look where they landed. He sat down in the middle of the deck and put his head in his hands. It was only then that real fear seemed to inhabit the men.
I can't live like that again, he said. I haven't got another 4 years to give.
The pilot said,
It wasn't a rogue wave, but the wake from a South Korean container vessel. They nearly swamped us.
The first mate said,
Let's run her aground near Wonsan and swim for it. Then, you know, the second mate just didn't make it. We'll make for a beach filled with retirees, and there will be plenty of witnesses. There are no retirees,
the captain said.
It's just what they tell you to keep you going.
Jundo said, We could go looking for him.
Suit yourself, the captain said.
Jundo shielded his eyes and looked again upon the waves.
Do you think he can survive out there? Do you think he can make it?
The first mate joined him.
His poor fucking wife. Without either the raft or the man, we're screwed,
the captain said.
With both gone, they'll never believe us.
There were fish scales on the deck, dry and flashing in the light. The captain ran a couple around with a finger.
If the Junma goes down, and we go down with her, he said, the mate's wives get pensions, and the machinist's wife gets a pension, the pilot's wife gets a pension. They all live.
They live with replacement husbands, the first mate said. What about my kids and some stranger raising them?
They live, the captain said. They stay out of the camps. The Americans were mad,
Jundo said.
They came back and they took him.
What's that?
The captain asked. He shielded his eyes and looked up at Jundo.
They wanted revenge, he said, and they came back to get the guy that had outfought them. They boarded us again, and they kidnapped the second mate.
The captain lay back on the deck in a strange position. He looked as if he'd fallen from the rigging and was in that moment where you don't move, where you're only trying to assess if anything's broken. He said,
If Pyongyang really thinks a citizen has been kidnapped by the Americans, they'll never let up. They'll ride it forever, and eventually the truth will come to light. Plus, there's no proof the Americans came back. The only thing that saved us last time was those idiots fooling with the radio.
From his pocket, Jundo produced the card that Jervis had left him, embossed with the seal of the U.S. Navy. He gave it to the captain. Maybe the Americans wanted Pyongyang to know exactly who had come and kicked some ass. In fact, it was the exact same guys. We all got a good look at them. We could tell almost the same story. The machinist said, We were long-lining when the Americans came aboard. They caught us by surprise. They grabbed the second mate and mocked him for a while, and then they threw him to the sharks.
Yeah,
the first mate said.
We threw the raft down to him, but the sharks tore it up with their teeth.
Yeah,
the pilot said.
The Americans just stood there with their guns, laughing while our comrade died.
The captain studied the card. He reached for a hand and they helped him up. There was that wild light in his eyes.
And then one of us, he said, without regard for his own safety, jumped into the shark-filled sea to save the second mate. This crewman suffered ferocious bite wounds, but he didn't care because he only thought about saving the second mate, a hero of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
but it was too late. Half eaten, the second mate slipped below the waves. His last words were of praise for the dear leader, and it was only in the nick of time that we pulled the other crew member, bleeding and half dead, back aboard the Junma.
Things suddenly got quiet. The captain told the machinist to start the winch.
"We'll need a fresh shock," he said.
The captain came to Jundo and cupped the back of his neck, pulling him close in a tender way until they were almost forehead to forehead. No one had ever done that to Jundo before, and it felt like there was no one else in the world. The captain said,
"It's not just because you're the one who put all the stupid ideas in the second mate's head, or that you're the one with the actress tattooed on your chest instead of a real woman at home depending on you. It's not because you're the one who's had military training in pain. It's because no one ever taught you about family and sacrifice and doing whatever it takes to protect your own."
The captain's eyes were open and calm, and so close to Jundo's that it felt they were communicating in some pure, wordless way. The hand on the back of his neck was solid, and Jundo found himself nodding. The captain said,
"You never had anyone to guide you, but I'm here, and I'm telling you this is the right thing to do. These people are your family, and I know you'd do anything for them. All that's left is the proof."
The shark had been hanging on the line all night and was stupid with death. When it came out of the water, its eyes were white, and on deck, it opened and closed its mouth less as if trying to take in oxygen than as if trying to expel whatever was slowly killing it. The captain told the pilot to get a firm grip on Jundo's arm, but no, Jundo said, he would hold it out himself. The mate and machinist hefted the shark, which was not quite 2 meters tip to tail. Jundo took a deep breath and turned to the captain. "Sharks and guns and revenge," he said. "I know I thought it up, but this isn't a story that anyone could really believe."
"You're right," the captain said, "but it's a story they can use."
After they radioed for help, a shore patrol boat escorted them to Kinje, where many people had gathered at the fish hauling ramp. There were a couple of representatives from the Ministry of Information and a pair of reporters from Rodong Shinmun, and there were some local security guys you'd never meet unless you drank. Steam poured from the new cannery, which meant they were in a sterilization cycle. So the workers sat on downturned buckets, waiting for a glimpse of the man who had fought the sharks. Even the urchins and cripple kids had come to eye the scene warily, through the glass of the live tanks, making their faces look large and distorted as schools of Aji swam by. A doctor approached Jundo with a unit of blood. The doctor searched for a vein in the wounded arm, but Jundo stopped him.
"If you put the blood in this arm, won't it all leak out?"
"Look, I only treat heroes," the doctor said, "so I know my way around blood, and where it's leaking from is exactly where it should go."
Then he ran the line into a vein behind the knuckle, taping it off and handing the bag to Jundo to hold high with his good arm. The doctor unwrapped the bloody t-shirt, and there was no denying the wound. The shark's teeth, like flakes of milk glass, had gone all the way, and when the troughs of flesh were irrigated, visible at the base of each of them was the white slick of arm bone. To the reporter and minister, Jundo gave a brief summary of his encounter with American aggression. They didn't ask many questions. It was corroboration they seemed interested in. Suddenly, before him was the older man with the flat top and busted hands who had taken away the second mate. He wore the same gray suit, and up close, Jundo could see his eyelids were very heavy, making it look as if he was resting his eyes while he spoke.
"I'll need to confirm the details of your story," he said, and flashed a silver badge that bore the name of no agency.
There was only an image of a thick block wall floating above the ground. Jundo was led down a path, his good arm holding the blood bag, the other in a sling. Ahead was the captain,
who was speaking with the wife of the second mate. They stood next to a pile of bricks, and she was not weeping. She eyed the old man and then Jun Do. Then she turned to the captain, who put an arm around her to console her. Jun Do looked back to the commotion at the dock, his mates gesturing large as they recounted the story, but they suddenly seemed very far away. The old man took him to the abandoned cannery. All that was left of the high-ceilinged factory were the giant steam chambers, the lonely gas manifolds, and the rusty tracks embedded in the cement floor. Shafts of light came down through holes in the roof, and here was a folding table and two chairs. On the table was a thermos. The old man sat and slowly unscrewed its raspy lid, with hands that worked as if through heavy mittens. Again he seemed to rest his eyes by closing them, but he was just old. "So are you an inspector or something?" Jun Do asked.
"What is the answer to that?"
the old man mused.
"I was very reckless in the war, and after we won, I was still ready for anything."
He leaned forward into the light, and Jun Do could see there were many scars in his short gray hair.
"I would have called myself an inspector back then."
Jun Do decided to play it safe. "It was great men like you who won the war and drove out the imperial aggressors." The old man poured tea into the lid of the thermos, but he did not drink it. He just held the steaming cup in both hands, slowly turning it.
"It's a sad story, this young fisherman friend of yours. The funny thing is that he really was a hero. I confirmed the story myself. He really did fight off armed Americans with only a fishing knife. Crazy stuff like that gains you respect, but loses friends. I know all about it. Perhaps that's what happened between the crew and the young mate."
Jun Do said, "The second mate didn't ask for the Americans to come back. He wasn't looking for trouble, let alone death. You did hear how he was eaten alive by sharks, right?" The old man didn't say anything. "Shouldn't you have a pencil or some paper or something?"
"We picked up your friend in a raft this morning. This was even before you radioed in about your so-called attack. He had plenty of cigarettes, but he had fumbled his matches and they were wet. They said your friend had been crying over what he'd done, that he couldn't stop."
Jun Do's mind turned on that. That poor, stupid boy, he thought. Jun Do had thought the two of them were in this together, but now he understood he was alone, and all he had was the story.
"I wish that lie you just told were true," Jun Do said, "because then the second mate would be alive. Then he wouldn't have died in front of all of us. Then the captain wouldn't have to tell his wife that she'll never see him again." "He'll never be seen again. You can count on that,"
the old man said. Again, it looked like he'd gone to sleep.
"Don't you want to know the reasons he defected? I believe he mentioned your name."
"The second mate was a friend and a hero," Jun Do said. "You should maybe show some respect for the dead." The old man stood.
"What I should maybe do is confirm your story,"
he said, and the first assault that followed was brief and frontal. Several snapping blows to the face, and with one arm hurt and the other holding the blood bag, there was nothing for Jun Do to do but take it.
"Tell me whose idea it was,"
the old man said. He struck Jun Do once on each collarbone.
"Why didn't you launch him farther south, closer to the DMZ?
Jun Do was somehow trapped in the chair, and two chopping blows to the floater ribs anchored him for good.
"Why didn't more of you defect, or were you casting him away?"
In quick succession, pain flashed in his neck, nose, and ear, and then his eyes didn't seem to work right.
"The Americans came back,"
Jun Do said.
"They were blaring music. They wore street clothes, including shoes with silver swooshes. One of them threatened to burn the ship. He had a lighter with a cruise missile on it. They had made fun of us because we didn't have a toilet, but now they made fun of us because we did.
The old man punched Jun Do directly in the breastplate, and in the fire of his new tattoo, he felt Sun Moon's face as a burning outline over his heart. The old man stopped to pour more tea, but he did not drink. He just warmed his hands around the cup. Jun Do now understood how it would go. In the military, his pain mentor was Kim San. The whole first week, they sat at a table, not unlike this one, and contemplated a candle burning between them. There was the flame, small and hot at its tip. There was the glow, warm on their faces. Then there was the darkness beyond the glow.
"Never let pain push you into the darkness,"
Kim San said.
"There you are nobody, and you are alone. Once you turn from the flame, it is over."
The old man began again, this time asking not about the second mate in the raft, but the second mate on the Junma, about how many sharks, how high the seas, whether the American rifles were on safety. The old man was pacing himself, dealing long, slow strings of measured blows to the cheeks and mouth and ears, switching to the soft body when his hands seemed to hurt.
"In the candle's flame, the fingertip hurts, though the whole rest of the body is in the warm glow of its light. Keep the pain in the fingertip and your body in the glow."
Jun Do put up his partitions. A strike to the shoulder must hurt only the shoulder, and he mentally cordoned that off from the rest of the body. And when the strikes came to the face, Jun Do would adjust his head as the strike was delivered, so no two landed in the same place.
"Keep the flame on the fingers. Keep the fingers in motion. Let the rest of you relax in the glow."
A wince of pain crossed the old man's face, and he stopped to stretch his back. Bending this way and that, he said,
"There's a lot of big talk about the war. Practically everyone was named a hero. Even trees have been named heroes. It's true. Everyone in my division is a war hero, except for the new guys, of course. Maybe your friend became a hero, and you didn't like that. Maybe you wanted to be one too."
Jun Do tried to stay in the glow, but he was having trouble focusing. He kept wondering when the next punch was coming.
"If you ask me," the old man said, "heroes are unstable and unpredictable. They get the job done, but damned if they're not difficult to work with. Trust me, I know," he said, and pointed to a long scar down his arm. "In my division, all the new guys are college types."
When the glint returned to the old man's eyes, he grabbed the back of Jun Do's neck to brace himself. Then came a series of dull blows to Jun Do's stomach.
"Who threw him in the water?"
he asked, and delivered one to the sternum.
"What were his last words?"
"One, two, three," they came.
"Why don't you know what the captain was doing?"
The fists pushed the air from his lungs.
"Why didn't you radio for help?"
Then the old man answered all his own questions.
"Because the Americans never came. Because you got tired of that crazy punk, and you killed him and threw him overboard. You're all going to the camps. You know that. It's already been decided. So you might as well just tell me."
The old man broke off. He paced for a moment, one hand inside the other, eyes shut with what seemed like relief. Then Jun Do heard Kim San's voice, as if he were very close, right in the room.
"You are the flame,"
Kim San said.
"The old man keeps touching the hot flame of you with only his hands."
Kim San would tell him to also hit with his elbows and forearms and feet and knees.
"But only his hands touch your flame. And look how it burns him."
"I can't say I was thinking," Jun Do said. "But when I jumped, the salt water on my new tattoo made me panic. The sharks would baby bite, muzzling you before they went for meat.
and the Americans were laughing with all their white teeth, and those two things became one in my head.
The old man came back in frustration.
No, he said. These are all lies.
Then he went to work again. As the blows came, he told Jundo everything that was wrong with the story. How they were jealous of the mate's new hero status. How Jundo couldn't remember people's clothes. How
the flame is tiny. It would take all day to burn the whole surface of your body. You must stay in the glow. You must never go into the darkness. For there you are alone, and people don't come back.
Kim San said this was the most difficult lesson for Jundo, because that's what he'd done as a boy, gone into the darkness. That was the lesson his parents had taught him, whoever they were. If you go into the darkness, if you turn off like that, you could do anything. You could clean tanks at the Pangu paint factory until your head throbbed and you coughed pink mist and the sky above turned yellow. You could good-naturedly smile when other kids got adopted by smelters and meat factories. And when you were crouched in the darkness, you could say, "Lucky you," and "So long," when men with Chinese accents came. It was difficult to tell how long the old man had been working on him. All his sentences ran together to make one sentence that didn't make sense. Jundo was there, in the water. He could see the second mate.
"I was trying to grab the second mate," Jundo said. "But his body would pop and jag and shift. And I knew what they were doing to him. I knew what was happening below the surface. In my hands, he didn't weigh anything. It was like trying to rescue a seat cushion. That's all that was left of him. But still, I couldn't do it."
When Jundo had cordoned off the pounding in his eyes and the hot blood in his nose, when he'd stopped the split in his lips and the sting in his ears from coming inside, when he'd blocked his arms and torso and shoulders from feeling, when that was all blocked off, there was only the inside of him. And what he discovered was a little boy in there, who was stupidly smiling, who had no idea what was happening to the man outside. And suddenly the story was true. It had been beaten into him, and he began crying because the second mate had died and there was nothing he could do about it. He could suddenly see him in the dark water, the whole scene lit by the red glow of a single flare.
"My friend," Jundo said, the tears streaming down his face. "I couldn't save him. He was alone and the water was dark. I couldn't even save a piece of him. I looked in his eyes and he didn't know where he was. He was calling for help, saying, 'I think I need a rescue,' his voice calm and eerie. And then my leg was going over the side and I was in the water."
The old man paused. He stood there with his hands held high, like a surgeon. They were covered with spit and mucus and blood. Jundo kept going.
"It's dark. I don't know where I am," he said. "I'm here," I told him. "Listen to the sound of my voice." He asked, "Are you out there?" I put my hand on his face, which was cold and white. "I can't be where I think I am," he said. "A ship is out there. I can't see its lights." That was the last thing he said. "I can't see its lights? Why would he say that?"
When Jundo said nothing, the old man asked,
"But you did try to rescue him, didn't you? Isn't that when you got bit? And the Americans, you said their guns were on you, right?"
The blood bag in Jundo's hand weighed 1,000 kilos, and it was all he could do to keep it aloft. When he managed to focus his eye, he saw that the bag was empty. He looked at the old man.
"What?"
he asked.
"Earlier, you said his last words were, 'All praise Kim Jong-il, dear leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.' You admit that's a lie."
The candle had gone out. The flame, the glow, the darkness. They were all suddenly gone and now there was nothing. Kim San never talked about what to do after the pain.
"Don't you see? It's all a lie,"
Jun Do said.
Why didn't I radio for help? Why didn't I get the crew to mount a real rescue? If the whole crew worked together, we could have saved him. I should have begged the crew. I should have gotten on my knees. But I didn't do anything. I just got wet. The only thing I felt was the sting of my tattoo.
The old man took the other chair. He poured fresh tea, and this time he drank it.
No one else got wet, he said. You don't see anyone else with a shark bite.
He looked around the building as if wondering for the first time what kind of place this was.
I'm going to retire soon, he said. Soon all the old-timers will be gone. I don't know what's going to happen to this country.
What will become of her? Jun Do asked.
The second mate's wife. Don't worry. We'll find someone good. We'll find someone worthy of his memory.
From his pack, the old man shook out a cigarette and with some struggle, lit it. The brand was Jolima, the kind they smoked in Pyongyang.
Looks like your ship is a regular hero factory, he said.
Jun Do kept trying to drop the blood bag, but his hand wouldn't let go. A person could learn to turn an arm off, so you didn't feel anything that happened to it. But how did you turn it back on?
I'm certifying you, the old man said. Your story checks out.
Jun Do turned to him.
What story are you talking about? What story?
The old man asked.
You're a hero now.
The old man offered Jun Do a cigarette, but Jun Do couldn't take it.
But the facts, Jun Do said, they don't add up. Where are the answers? There's no such thing as facts. In my world, all the answers you need to know come from here.
He pointed at himself, and Jun Do couldn't tell if the old man indicated his heart, his gut, or his balls.
But where are they?
Jun Do asked. He could see the girl rower shooting flares his way. He could feel the mate's cold cheek as the sharks pulled him under.
Will we ever find them?
Jun Do dreamed of sharks biting him, of the actress Sun Moon blinking and squinting the way Rumina had when the sand was in her eyes. He dreamed of the second mate drifting farther and farther into that harsh light. A stab of pain would arrive. And was he awake or asleep? His eyes roamed the insides of lids swollen shut. The endless smell of fish. Shockwork whistles signaled dawn, and he knew night had arrived when the hum of a little fridge went off with the power. All his joints felt locked up, and taking too deep a breath was like opening the furnace slats of pain. When his good arm could finally reach over to inspect the bad arm, he could feel fat horsefly hairs, the coarse thread of surgical stitching. He had a half-memory of the captain helping him up the stairs of the community housing block where the second mate lived with his wife. The loudspeaker, "Citizens!" took care of him during the day. Afternoons, she came from the cannery, the faint smell of machine oil still on her hands. The little teapot would rattle and whistle, and she would hum along with the march of Kim Jong-il, which signaled the end of the news. Then her hands, ice-cold with alcohol, would disinfect his wounds. Those hands rolled him left and right to change the sheets and empty his bladder, and he was sure he could feel in her fingers the trace of her wedding ring. Soon, the swelling had gone down, and now it was gunk sealing his eyes shut rather than inflammation. She was there with a hot cloth to steam them open.
There he is, she said when his vision was finally back. The man who loves Sun Moon.
Jun Do lifted his head. He was on a pallet on the floor, naked under a light yellow sheet. He recognized the louvered windows of the housing block. The room was strung with little perch, drying on wires like laundry. She said,
My father believed that if his daughter married a fisherman, she'd never starve.
And into focus, came the second mate's wife.
"What floor are we on?"
he asked.
"The 10th."
"How'd you get me up here?"
"It wasn't so bad. The way my husband described you, I thought you'd be a lot bigger."
She ran the hot cloth over his chest, and he tried not to wince.
"Your poor actress. Her face is black and blue. It makes her look old, like her time has passed. Have you seen her movies?"
Shaking his head no made his neck hurt.
"Me either,"
she said.
"Not in this dumpy town. The only movie I ever saw was a foreign film, a love story."
She immersed the cloth in hot water again, then soaked the ridges of all his scars.
"It was about a ship that hits an iceberg and everybody dies."
She climbed onto the pallet next to him. With both arms, she muscled him over and onto his side. She held a jar to him and maneuvered it until his umgyong was inside.
"Come on,"
she said, then gave him a couple claps on the back to get him going. His body pulsed in pain, and then the stream began. When he was done, she lifted the jar to the light. The fluid was cloudy and rust-colored.
"Getting better,"
she announced.
"Soon you'll be walking down the hall to the 10th floor toilet like a big boy."
Jundo tried to roll onto his back by himself, but he couldn't. So he just lay there, curled on his side. On the wall, beneath the portraits of the deer and great leaders, was a little shelf with the second mate's America shoes on them. Jundo tried to figure out how the second mate had gotten them home, when the whole crew had seen them go into the water. Tacked large on the wall was the main chart from the Junma. It showed the entire Korean Sea, and it was the chart by which all the other charts on board were referenced. They'd thought it burned with the others in the fire. On it were pushpins marking every fishing ground they'd visited, and in pencil were traced the coordinates of several northerly positions.
"Is that the course of the rowers?" Jundo asked her.
"The rowers?"
she asked.
"This is a map of all the places he'd been. The red pins are cities he'd heard about. He was always talking about the places he'd take me."
She looked into Jundo's eyes. "What?" he asked.
"Did he really do it? Did he really pull a knife on American commandos? Or is that some bullshit story you guys cooked up?"
"Why would you listen to me?"
"Because you're an intelligence officer," she said. "Because you don't give a shit about anybody around this backwater. When your mission's done, you'll go back to Pyongyang and never think about fishermen again."
"And what's my mission?"
"There's going to be a war at the bottom of the ocean," she said. "Maybe my husband shouldn't have told me, but he did."
"Don't fool yourself," he said. "I'm just a radio guy. And yes, your husband took on the U.S. Navy with a knife."
She shook her head with muted admiration.
"He had so many crazy plans," she said. "Hearing that makes me think if he'd have lived, he might have really gone through with one."
She ladled the sweetened rice water into Jundo's mouth and rolled him back, covering him with a sheet again. The room was getting dark, and soon the power would fail.
"Look, I've got to go out," she said. "If you have an emergency, give a yell, and the floor official will come. She's at the door if someone so much as farts in here."
She took a sponge bath by the door, where he couldn't see her. He could only hear the faint sound of the cloth on her skin and the sound of water as it dripped from her body to the pan she crouched in. He wondered if it was the same cloth she'd used on him. Before she left, she stood over him in a dress that bore the wrinkles of having been hand-wrung and hung to dry. Though he beheld her through the oceany vision of newly opened eyes, it was clear she was a true beauty, tall and square-shouldered, yet cloaked in a soft layer of baby fat. Her eyes were large and unpredictable, and black bobbed hair framed a round face. She had an English dictionary in her hand,
I've seen some people,